Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
When Thomas Aquinas was a young man, he composed a short treatise on philosophy titled in English, On Being in Essence. In this brief work, he lays down profound metaphysical insights into the nature of reality and offers a unique and powerful argument for the existence of God. Unfortunately, most, especially in the Protestant community, have never heard of this argument for God, and those who have heard of it often struggle to understand it. So today we're going to take a close look at Aquinas' philosophical insights and the proof that he draws from them. And to help us through this, I'm delighted to be joined today by the man who literally wrote the book on Aquinas' argument for God in On Being in Essence, Dr. Gavin Kerr. Gavin, welcome to Think for Christ.
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me on the show. I'm very happy to be here. You know, this is great stuff and, you know, great that you're going through this. So looking forward to doing a deep dive into the argument from the De Ante.
Would you just mind taking a moment to introduce yourself to the Think for Christ community?
Yeah. So as you were saying, I'm Gavin Kerr, Dr. Gavin Kerr. You can probably tell by the accent, I'm Irish. I'm from Northern Ireland, originally from Belfast. So I was born in Belfast in 1983, and I did all of my degrees at Queen's University, Belfast. So I did an undergraduate BA degree in scholastic philosophy and philosophy. I did a master's by research in philosophy. My master's in research was on the distinction of essence and existence in Aquinas. And then I did a PhD at Queen's University on the thought, Aquinas' epistemological thought, in dialogue with Kant's transcendental idealism. And so they were all finished up in 2011. So it took me about 10 years to get all my degrees. And then I just sort of fell into teaching academia during my PhD years, as many of us academics do. We do a bit of teaching and then we just end up staying there. We don't leave the mothership. And so I just stayed in it. And I published articles, stuff like that. And then the book on the De Ante, you know, really just came together around the early teens, you know, 2012, 13, you know, I'd been publishing articles and this stuff, and the book started to come together, and sent it off to Oxford with the help of Brian Davies, who gave me some advice. And it was published, and, you know, people seemed to like it. And, you know, here we are today.
All right. Well, Gavin, one of the things that drew me personally to Aquinas early on was his depth of thought. Aquinas, more than anyone else, in my opinion, was able to reach the deepest levels of reality and uncover the most foundational principles of being. Yeah. And it has always seemed to me that with Aquinas, we've reached metaphysical bedrock. Mm. Now, the problem is he is so deep and he's so profound that he can be very difficult to understand. So, Gavin, by way of introducing our listeners to the thought of Aquinas, can you help us understand what was the primary and original contribution that he made to philosophy? How did Aquinas go beyond the philosophical thought of those that had come before him?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So this takes us right back to the beginnings of philosophy and the pre-Socratics and then in Plato and Aristotle, because depending on how much philosophy your listeners are aware of, there was a big problem in pre-Socratic philosophy known as the one and the many. And this is typified by two pre-Socratic philosophers, Parmenides and Heraclitus. The pre-Socratics were concerned with just the nature of reality, and you could say that they were, you know, the originators of rationalistic investigation of reality. They were a mixture of scientists, philosophers of nature, astronomers, that sort of thing. And one of them, Heraclitus, he sort of conceived of the principle of all reality as being fire. So fire is what is at the heart of all reality. And you can kind of see why he thought that, because if you think about fire, everything is subject to it. Nothing can escape the activity of fire. So it seems to be what's most actual, what's most sort of overpowering of everything. So that would be the for Heraclitus, you know, it was a neat inference to hold that that is, you know, the constitutive principle of everything. But then when we think about fire is something that in order to be fire, it has to continually sort of be in flux, be in motion. It's always burning. Once it stops burning, it's ceasing to be fire. So if fire is at the heart of all reality, then reality itself is constituted by flux. And this is brought out in Heraclitus's really famous principle, or kind of, you know, little quip, that you can't step into the same river twice. You know, the waters are constantly flowing. So Heraclitus's point there, if we think of the river, there is kind of like a river. There's an identifiable river, the Mississippi if you're in the States, or, you know, the Ligon if you're in Belfast. And it's flowing, it's constantly moving. But out of that constant flow, we have an identifiable unity. So unity emerges out of the flux. Unity isn't primary. The flux is what's primary. And that's Heraclitus. But then Parmenides comes along and he holds that being is the principle of all reality. So being is what governs all of reality. And the one thing that we can know about being is that being is and non-being is not. And you can't mix the two of them together. Being is and non-being is not. And with that in place, Parmenides denies the reality of change. Denies that change is real. And this is because in order to have change, something has to not be what it becomes. And when it becomes something, it has to cease to be what it was. So change requires non-being intermingled with being. And for Parmenides, well, that just breaks the principle that being is and non-being is not. So change is an illusion. And notice the dichotomy of those two positions. Heraclitus, flux is at the heart of all reality. And unity is what emerges. Parmenides, unity is at the heart of all reality, and flux is just an appearance. It's not real. And we have two mutually opposed positions here. How do we accommodate the insights of both? Because both are pretty insightful. This is where Plato and Aristotle come along. Plato and Aristotle point out that we can affirm both the unity and the flux of reality. We just don't have to affirm that reality is both unified and in flux in the same way. So reality or being is an analogous notion, to use Aristotle's language, or a plurivocal notion. It has many different designations. And Plato and Aristotle bring this out in the respective theory of form. Because for both Plato and Aristotle, form is at the height of all reality, or at the heart of all reality. Reality is constituted by form, and then depending on how something is related to form, it is more or less real. So for Plato, you have the abstract forms into which everything participates, ultimately the form of the good, and everything participates in it, and a thing is related to its form the way a shadow is related to its object. It's less real than its object, and it wouldn't exist without its object, and the object is more real than the shadow. So the shadow merely participates in the reality of the object. For Aristotle, form is the constituting principle of matter. It's what organizes the matter to produce the individual physical substance. But for both of them, reality is explicable ultimately in terms of form. That's what reality is explicable in terms of. And that kind of brought us a further step along the way in the philosophical problem. Generally in philosophy, where you get an advance in the problem when with two mutually opposing positions, you can find a third position that accommodates both of them. And that's what we get in Plato and Aristotle. And that was fine as far as it goes. But the Neoplatonists came along And the Neoplatonists, they're Platonists, so Plato is the man for them, but they're aware of the Aristotelian critique of Plato and his separate forms. And the Neoplatonists, especially in Proclus and Plotinus, they held that there's a principle of reality which is even beyond form, even more fundamental than form. And this principle of reality beyond form was the One, okay? So all of reality is unified in the One. And one of the reasons for holding this is because every being that you see is a unified being. You don't have a being unless it's unified. So unity seems to be the principle at the heart of all being, and even form is subject to unity, to the One. So everything participates in the One. Now, that insight that there's a principle beyond form to which even form is subject is something that St. Thomas Aquinas was influenced by. He wouldn't have had a direct knowledge of Plotinus. He did have a knowledge of Proclus later on in his life, whenever Proclus became available, but he wouldn't have had a direct knowledge of Plotinus. But Thomas appreciated this notion that there needs to be some sort of principle beyond form, because form only explains the what of the thing, what a thing is. It doesn't, you know, explain why there is something rather than nothing. Because there's lots of things which don't exist which have forms. Pegasus has a form. We know what the form of Pegasus is. We know what the form of a phoenix is. And we know what the form of a human being is. The difference between Pegasus and a phoenix is...
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Just because these things have a form doesn't mean they exist. Human beings do exist. They have a form, but insofar as they have a form, insofar as in the having of a form, they have that in common with non-existent things, they have to have something else by which they exist. And what we see Thomas defending from his earliest days, and we get this in the De Entia Essentia, which we can get into, is that things that exist have a metaphysical sort of principle beyond even form, which he calls esse, which is just the Latin of to be. They have an active existence without which there would be nothing. So what St. Thomas brings to the table here is the active existence, something which Plato and Aristotle didn't really envisage. They thought if a thing had a form, then, of course, ipso facto, it exists. St. Thomas adds the active existence to the philosophical itinerary. And you kind of mentioned that we're reaching metaphysical bedrock here. And this is because if the active existence, existence is the principle by which something is rather than is not, then we can't go beyond that. There's nothing beyond existence which can account for the existence of the thing. Existence is literally that which distinguishes something from nothing. The Neoplatonists thought it was the One, and there was something to that, but the One isn't exactly the active existence. One can envisage something even beyond unity, which accounts for the existence of things. And so Thomas, in latching on to existence, reaches metaphysical bedrock, and that's that in which everything participates and in which everything is unified. So I hope that's okay by way of an introduction.
That was just a great history lesson and great setup here for our discussion on this little book by Aquinas on being in essence. So if you wouldn't mind, Gavin, could you just kind of walk us through the principles that Aquinas lays down and then how he draws out an argument for God from those?
Yeah, that's no problem. So we have this little treatise. It's De Entia Essentia, on being in essence. Thomas writes this when he's in his early 30s. He's the equivalent of a PhD student in theology at the University of Paris. And he's a Dominican at the time. He's a member of the Order of Preachers. So any of your listeners, if they don't know what a Dominican is, well, a Dominican friar, big white habit with a big black cape. Okay, that's a Dominican friar. I'm a third order Dominican, so I'm not a friar, so I don't get the habit. Okay, but he's a Dominican friar, and he's living with the other friars at Saint Jacques, and he's a student at Saint Jacques, which is in Paris, and he's doing his PhD. Now there are other friars there who are just starting out on the wonderful world of philosophy. And like any student starting out in the wonderful world of philosophy, they're getting confused. They don't understand things. They just don't get it. And we've all been there, and it's all happened to us. So the first thing they do, like every student, you know, that has ever gone to university, they don't go to the master, who would have been Albert, St. Albert. Well, he wasn't a saint then, but he was Albert then. They wouldn't have gone to the master. For some reason, students don't go to the lecturer or the master when they're confused. They go to other students. Okay, in the hope that the other students will help them out. So instead of going to the master with whom they lived, Albert, they weren't going to bother him. They went to Brother Thomas, who had completed his philosophy and was doing his PhD in theology. And so they need some help from Thomas to understand metaphysics. And Thomas is like, not a problem. He writes the De Ente et Essentia for them. It's about 5 or 6 chapters, depending on which edition that you have. About 30 pages in length. You can read it in an afternoon. It'll take you a few hours. Now, you can't understand it in one afternoon, but you can read it. Yeah. So he writes this treatise for them where he outlines the principles of metaphysics. Now, just to sort of skip to what we're interested in, one of the issues that he's concerned with is the metaphysical principles of things that exist. And he starts with physical things. And he holds it, you know, okay, physical things have an essence. And because they're physical things, their essence has to include their form, yes, but also their matter. Because their matter is just as essential to them as their form is. You can't consider the essence of a physical thing without considering that by which it is physical, which is its matter taken under, you know, certain determinate dimensions. And Thomas is like, right, fair enough. And he goes through all of that. But then he gets to the point, well, what about immaterial things? Okay. We don't need to be committed to the reality of immaterial things, but if we're going to give a metaphysical account of all reality, that should, in principle, explain immaterial things, should they exist. Okay, so even if you're a pure-blooded materialist, your metaphysics should still be able to accommodate the possibility of non-material things. Otherwise, it just isn't a good metaphysics. Okay, so Thomas is, you know, he comes upon this sort of issue. And it's like, you know, what about immaterial creatures? Let's say angels, all right? Or what, you know, the sort of ancient Greeks would have called separate substances. What about them? Do they, you know, they have an essence. And, you know, is their essence composed of matter and form? Well, if they're immaterial, we want to say that they don't have matter. So they would just be pure forms. But think back to our Plato and Aristotle. If they're just pure forms and they don't have any matter, then they have no potency. They don't have any potency or change or variability. So it would seem that they are pure actuality. Utterly simple, purely actual. And this is a bit of a problem, theologically and metaphysically, because if these immaterial creatures, let's just say angels, are purely actual, utterly simple, then they're like God. There's no difference between them and God. Because God is utterly simple, has no matter and all the rest, and yet they are creatures. Okay, they're not God; they're envisaged to be creatures. So we're led into this problem. And now, I mean, setting aside this whole issue of angels and God and stuff, the question is matter the fundamental principle of potency, such that in order to have potency, you have to be material, and without matter, you don't have any potency. And correspondingly, is form the fundamental principle of actuality, such that if you are a pure form, you're purely actual? That's what Thomas is trying to deal with. And now, there was a very popular position derived from the Franciscan school, going back to St. Augustine, I believe, which held that there are two types of matter. There's matter which is corporeal, which is the three-dimensional stuff that we can touch, but there's also incorporeal matter, matter not subject to dimensionality. And this sort of position, it was called universal hylomorphism, I'll just explain what that term means. Hylomorphism means matter, form, composition. So that if you have a substance, it's made up of matter, but it's formed in a certain way to make it that kind of substance. And universal hylomorphism held that that applies not just to physical corporeal things, but also to non-physical things, such as angels. And these angels, they have incorporeal matter. Okay, matter which isn't corporeal. And so to get around this problem of holding that immaterial things would be pure forms and pure actuality, the universal hylomorphists held that these immaterial creatures, they do have matter, it's just not corporeal matter. Now, Thomas reacts to this. Now, he's in his early 30s. He immediately reacts to this and he rejects it. He believes that it commits us to a plurality of forms view about substances, which he rejects. He also thinks it's a bit ad hoc. You know, really, you're kind of just, you know, making up this solution because you've come across a problem. You know, your outlook didn't envisage all of this and you're kind of just trying to deal with it as it comes along. And he also thinks it's a bit just odd to say that immaterial things have matter. And so he rejects it. But in rejecting it, he has to give an account of how it is possible to have immaterial things which aren't pure actuality. And the underlying metaphysical issue here is, what is the principle, the ultimate principle of actuality and the ultimate principle of potency? Well, Thomas is going to say, even though you have these immaterial creatures, let's say, okay, they don't have matter, but that doesn't mean that they're pure actuality. They do have an element of potency, a tinge of potentiality to them in the English translation, and that's their potentiality for existence. Their essence that they have stands in potency to an act of existence. So the essence of, say, the angel Michael or Gabriel, that stands in potency to an act of existence by which that creature is something rather than nothing. So you still have potency and composition in the thing. It's just not the potency of matter and form. And again, what you see here is Thomas's Neoplatonism coming out, because it means that whilst form is the highest principle within the essence, it structures the matter if the thing has matter, or it constitutes the essence if the thing is immaterial, that form itself stands in potency to something even higher beyond form, which is the act of existence. And that's where Thomas is going in the De Ente et Essentia. That's in chapter 4. Mm-hmm. Now, that articulates the position he wants to defend, but he has to go on to show that there's a distinction.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Between essence and existence in these things? And then from there, from establishing distinction of essence and existence, that's where he arrives at a primary source of all existence, which isn't subject to that distinction, which is pure existence itself.
Yeah, great. So Aquinas, again, he's pushing deeper into the nature of reality here, because yeah. for Aristotle, for example, Aristotle stopped at form. Correct? Mm-hmm. Because once you have the form of something, mm-hmm. Then you have kind of the intelligibility of the thing. You have the reason for the thing. You have the explanation for the thing. But Aquinas says, we have to go further, right? Can you just unpack that a little? Why essay? Why this mm-hmm. act of existence?
Yeah, yeah. So when Aristotle's a scientist, okay, through and through, he's a philosopher of nature, he's a biologist, all of that. When he's looking at things, he's going out into the world, he's seeing the things, and it's like, look, what's going to give us, you know, the complete explanation of this thing? And ultimately, that's going to terminate in form. Aristotle's not asking the question, well, you know, what makes it something rather than nothing? Uh-huh. You know, Aristotle's just sitting thinking, well, of course the thing exists. Here it is here. So granted its existence, you know, how do we explain its existence? That's what Aristotle's after. But it's the Neoplatonists who come after Aristotle, and they're saying, look, this concern with being, it has to extend to all of being. You know, Aristotle talks about, you know, the first philosophy being a consideration of being as being. The Neoplatonists held, well, if that's the case, then we need to explain why, you know, there is something rather than nothing. And that's the question which is motivating St. Thomas. Yes, St. Thomas is concerned, you know, with how do we investigate being qua being, and then we give the various categories of being and, you know, the constitutive principles. But the fundamental question in metaphysics for Thomas is, why is there something rather than nothing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's what SA is doing. That's what the act of existence is doing. So it's very much a Neoplatonic approach to the Aristotelian project of first philosophy that he's taken here.
Great, great. So we have the act of existence and we have essence. Can you explain for us a little bit Aquinas's conception of essence and then how existence and essence work as principles of being?
Yeah. The essence is what the thing is, and it's captured by the definitional content of the thing. So if we have a genuine definition of the thing, that captures the essence. So if we take, you know, say a human being to be a rational animal, we define a human being to be an animal that is rational, then the essence of a human is rational animality. That's what makes it a human as opposed to a different type of animal, a canine animal, let's say. So that's what essence is. It's what the thing is, and it constitutes it as the kind of thing that it is. And for Thomas, if it's a material thing, the essence then is basically just the unity of the thing's matter and form. That's what the essence is. If it's an immaterial thing, it's its form alone. So the essence of St. Michael, let's say, is just the particular angelic form that he has or that he instantiates. That's what essence is. Essay, then, is that metaphysical principle of the thing without which it would be nothing. Okay, so it makes, you know, that thing with an essence something rather than nothing. So you have the existent, the thing that exists. It has an essence, and it exists as an existent because it has this act of existence.
Great, great. Yeah, so essence kind of describes the what a thing is, and esse accounts for why it is, for why it exists.
Yeah, yeah. Esse is what makes it exist. And I'm glad you said it accounts for why it exists, because a lot of people say that essence accounts for the what, and esse accounts for the that. It exists. And it's a bit of a bugbear of mine. It's very technical sort of stuff, but I'm one of those Thomists that hold that SA doesn't correlate with the that of the thing's existence. But it does account, as you just said, for why a thing exists.
Right, because at the end of the day, SA is an act, right? It's an act of existence.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah,
go on. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, so just trying to dig around these principles. So why don't we proceed then in Aquinas' thinking here in on being an essence and kind of unpack where he goes from here and how he develops this argument for the existence of God.
Yeah, brilliant. So we're in chapter 4 of the De Ante. In most editions of the De Ante, this comes up in chapter 4. Now, Aquinas has articulated that he rejects universal hylomorphism, and he holds that everything stands in potency to an act of existence. Okay, well, all creatures anyway stand in potency to an act of existence. But he needs to demonstrate this. He needs to prove that there's a distinction between essence and existence. He can't just, you know, suggest an alternative account and say, well, look, mine's is better. He needs to actually give a proof for it. And that's the cool thing about Thomas. You always get a proof for a position, you know, that he's, you know, adopting. And it's almost always from metaphysics. Metaphysics always permeates into everything with St. Thomas. And in fact, if I could just, you know, make a little bit of a side there, and it's something that you sort of brought up, that when we're getting to this argument for God's existence, Thomas is just digging deep into the nature of reality. So really what his project is to try and think about what the nature of being is. And as he's doing that, he comes to a proof of God's existence. But he doesn't set out that way. He doesn't set out to say, you know, I'm going to prove God. It's, well, this is the way being is, yada, yada,
that's
yada.
That's what makes it so cool, I think, in this on being in essence. It's just like, he's just, like I said, he's just digging around for these principles of being. And then once he has them, it's like, oh, and these principles actually imply the existence of God. I think that's really cool about this little book.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the important thing to understand about St. Thomas is that God's existence, it's a conclusion of metaphysics. He's not setting out to do apologetics of, you know, like, right, here's an argument for God's existence. Any argument, let's get it. No, he's doing metaphysics, and then the proof for God's existence comes in later. In the same way that the proof for the causal principle comes in, or the proof for hylomorphism comes in, God's existence is another aspect of metaphysics and not just an apologetical endeavor that a lot of contemporary theistic philosophers engage in. But anyway, so on to the distinction of essence and existence. So he needs to establish that essence and existence are distinct. And there are this argument proceeds in three stages. There's the first stage of argumentation where Thomas appeals to how we think about being in essence. And it's called the intellectus essentiae stage. The Latin there is the understanding of essence argument. Then there's a stage after that where Thomas considers the different types of multiplication, how things are multiplied. And then in the third stage, you have the proof for the existence of God proper. And for each of those stages, there's been a Thomistic commentator who has said that's the stage at which Thomas establishes real distinction of essence and existence. Now, no commentator disagrees, you know, that Thomas actually does establish a real distinction. They just disagree where he does it. They all agree that he does do it somewhere. It's just where. So that disagreement among scholars is a very sort of niche Thomistic disagreement. I'm going to focus on the first two stages. The reason being is that the third stage, it's the proof for God's existence proper. And on my reading and on the reading of several others, the proof of God's existence presupposes real distinction of essence and existence. And if it presupposes it, then it can't establish it. For any of the listeners who are interested, it's Joseph Owens who defends real distinction at stage three, that you only have real distinction after you've proven God's existence. But I'm going to focus on stages one and two, and they sort of lead us up then to the proof of God, stage three.
Great.
Is that okay? Is that good?
Sounds great.
Yeah, brilliant. So the first stage, the intellectus essentiae stage, Thomas says, well, look, consider how we think about being in essence, okay? And he states that whatever doesn't enter into the understanding of an essence or a quiddity is just, you know, use that interchangeably for essence. It just means the whatness of the thing. Whatever doesn't enter into our understanding of an essence or a quiddity is distinct from that essence and composed with it from without. Now, we're assuming a true of veridical understanding here, okay? So if we have a true understanding of an essence or a quiddity, and there's something that doesn't enter into that understanding, it's distinct from the essence or quiddity understood and composed with it from without. And Thomas says, the reason for this is because in order to understand an essence, you need to understand the parts of an essence, okay? And so if you've understood the essence, you've understood its parts. And if there's some feature, okay, that doesn't enter into that understanding, it's not a part of that essence, okay? He says, you know, he goes on and he says, but look, you can understand an essence or a quiddity without understanding that it exists. So, for instance, you can understand what a phoenix is and what a man is.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Is okay, a rational animal for a man, a phoenix, you know, a bird that rises from the ashes of its own death. You can understand the essences of these things, but that doesn't mean that they exist. Understanding that they exist is something different. Therefore, Thomas concludes, essence and existence are distinct in things, unless there's something whose essence is identical to its existence. And that's the first stage. Okay, so that's the first stage of argumentation. Now, just on the scholarly issue, there are some authors who hold that at that stage, Thomas has established that essence and existence are distinct in real things. So if you go out into the world and find a real thing, there's a distinction between essence and existence in it. And so Edward Fieser holds that position. I believe that Anthony Kenny holds that position. Stephen Long holds that position. And there's a number of reputable scholars who think that's where Thomas not only succeeds in establishing, but also intended to establish real distinction of essence and existence. I hold that at that stage, Thomas has only established that essence and existence are distinct in our thinking of these things. So what Thomas is referring to there is how we think about these things. He hasn't shown that they're distinct in reality.
Can I interject a technical question here? Do you think, so I follow you here on interpreting Aquinas in this work, and I agree. However, would you say, is there, like when I think of Fieser, he gives distinct arguments for how we can identify a real distinction between essence and existence. Do you think there are ways that you could come to that distinction in things wholly apart from interpreting what's happening in Aquinas in this particular work? Or do you think that this is the only way, what Aquinas does here is the only way to get to the real distinction?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the more I've thought about this, the more I think that if we presuppose that in our thinking about the essence and existence of a thing, if we have within our sights a real subsistent thing, and we're forming, you know, veridical understandings of that real subsistent thing, then I think you can affirm of that thing that essence and existence are distinct. Now, I don't think that amounts to a distinction of essence and existence as a metaphysical, as a conclusion of metaphysics, that it's a metaphysical teaching that they're distinct. But I think you could infer that in this thing before you, essence and existence are distinct. I think that's correct.
Do you think you can get to a real distinction there, or just a conceptual distinction?
A real distinction in that individual, if we presuppose that our understandings are focused on a real individual.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But I don't think that generalizes to a conclusion of metaphysics, that it's a metaphysical truth that things are like that.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So I think at most what Fieser and Long establish is that if you have a real thing in front of you, then only in that thing do you have real distinction. But that doesn't generalize into the kind of metaphysical conclusion that Thomas needs.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
But in any case, Aquinas follows a different path. So, yeah, we can get back to that.
Yeah, well, so I think at this stage, and I'm not alone, John Whipple, Joseph Owens, they both hold that at this stage, all we've established is a conceptual distinction, that how we think about essence is different from how we think about the existence of the thing. But that doesn't mean that essence and existence are distinct in the thing itself. So we can think about the morning star and the evening star. They're distinct in sense, but identical in reference. They both refer to the planet Venus. Or you can think of the breakfast table and the dinner table, both distinct in sense. But if you're like me, it's the same table. It's one and the same thing in reality. Yeah. So myself, Whipple, and Owens, we hold that it's at a later stage that essence and existence are established as really distinct. And if I may just point out, So it's at stage two that I think the real distinction is established. John Whipple also, you know, he holds that, I'm following John Whipple on this. He holds that it's at stage two that real distinction is established. And just in the last few days, Professor John Whipple, he passed away there just yesterday, September 11th.
Oh, that's a shame.
Passed away. Yeah, one of the greatest exegetes and, you know, commentators on Aquinas' metaphysics of the 20th and 21st century.
Yeah, I love Whipple.
Yeah, so he passed away just yesterday there. So, yeah. So just, yeah, so it's interesting that we're recording today.
And, yeah, really, really.
Yeah.
What was the name of his really thick book? I have it up in my library, but I can't remember.
The Metaphysical Thought of Thomas Aquinas.
The Metaphysical Thought of Thomas Aquinas. Just a tour de force. I mean, anyone interested in Aquinas has to get that book. It is such an excellent work.
Yeah, published in 2000 by CUA and unsurpassed, I think.
I agree. Yeah. No.
It, It's the textbook for Aquinas' metaphysics. I think, yeah, definitely. Any of the listeners listening should really get that book.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're at stage two. And so let's just say conceptual distinction is stage one. Essence and existence are distinct in how we think about them. We still need to establish that in real things, it's a metaphysical truth that in such things, essence and existence are distinct. So what does Thomas do at stage two? Well, you'll remember at the end of stage one, he says essence and existence are distinct unless there's something whose essence is identical to its existence. And Thomas says, let's consider that as a hypothetical. So let's consider hypothetically something whose essence is its existence. We're not committed to its reality, but just hypothetically, what would it be like for that? Okay, something whose essence is its existence. What would that be like? And what Thomas argues is that it would be one and unique. It would be utterly unique. It wouldn't just be one as in there's only one such thing, but there could be more. It would be such that there could at most only be one such thing. So it would be utterly unique. And we'll see what Thomas does with that. But St. Thomas, he holds that something whose essence is its existence, if it exists, would be completely unique. Well, why? Well, Thomas takes us through the different ways in which things could be multiplied. And I really have to credit Whipple with, you know, focusing on this argument, because I think it's a real ingenious argument for real distinction, which wasn't really brought out in the literature until Whipple came along. And so Thomas holds at this stage. Now, remember, Thomas is in his early 30s. He's like, you know, 30 to 32 years old here. But Thomas, he outlines the different types of multiplication, how things could be multiplied. He says, well, look, first of all, you can multiply things the way a genus is multiplied into its species. So if you take a genus, some sort of generic, you know, general notion like animal, it's multiplied into its various species by adding to it from without. So we can differentiate or specify the genus animal by adding to it rationality, canininity, felininity. And by adding these differentiating features, we get the species rational animal, canine animal, feline animal, humans, dogs, cats. So in order to multiply a genus into its species, you have to add something from outside the genus which specifies it. And Thomas holds, well, look, something whose essence is its existence couldn't be multiplied in this way. Because think about it. If, you know, we're thinking of the genus, something whose essence is its existence, it's pure existence. In order to multiply it like a genus, you have to take something from outside of existence and add it to it. But what exists outside of existence?
Nothing.
Nothing, yeah. So there's nothing outside of it which could be added to it, which could specify it. So it can't be multiplied in this generic kind of way. And Thomas is like, right, okay, what's next? And he says, well, look, we can multiply species into individual members of the species by adding matter. So you take the species human, rational animality. Okay, now every human has rational animality in common. So what distinguishes individual humans? Well, Thomas says that it's matter. It's distinct chunks of matter. My rational animality is embedded in my, you know, chunk of matter, which let's just say originated 12th of April, 1983. And that's distinct from your chunk of matter, which originated at a different period. And those two matters can't occupy the same place at the same time. So we are individuals of that species because of those chunks of matter. So maybe something which is pure existence could be multiplied in that way. And Thomas says, well, no. Because not only would you have to add something to it from outside of it, which we've already seen we can't do, but it would also mean that such a thing would subsist in its matter. And the problem with that is that something whose essence is its existence doesn't subsist in its matter. It subsists in itself. Because its essence is its existence, it subsists in what it is, not in something other than it, which is its matter. So something whose essence is its existence couldn't be multiplied material.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Really? And then he outlines a third mode of multiplication, which he doesn't actually consider. The third way in which something could be multiplied is if you have something which is separate and absolute, and other things come to participate in it. And he gives the example of a separate source of heat, let's say a fire, to which everything draws near in order to participate in its heat. Its heat is multiplied in that way. Now, it's obvious why Thomas doesn't consider that mode of multiplication, because the thing, the separate source, the absolute source, is not actually multiplied in itself. You know, you never get more than one of them. You already have multiple things which come to draw upon the actuality of that thing. Think of the sun and participating in the light of the sun. Everything which is illuminated doesn't multiply the sun. They just fall under the illumination of the sun. Yeah. And in fact, that's how Thomas is going to envisage creatures in a relationship to God. But Thomas doesn't consider that third mode of multiplication because it doesn't actually multiply the thing. And with that, Thomas holds that something whose essence is its existence could not be multiplied in any way. And just before we finish up with that, one needs to ask, well, is he exhaustive there? Are there other modes of multiplication, you know, that we could consider? He's really only considered two which are applicable. Maybe there's more. And so one of the things that I sort of did in my 2015 book was to sort of try to get behind Thomas's argument and ask, what are the principles driving it? And it seems that in all those modes of multiplication, in order for a thing to be multiplied, it has to be subject to something which multiplies it. There's some sort of principle of multiplication which multiplies the thing.
Right.
Okay. So it exercises some sort of actuality on the thing and multiplies it. So the thing to be multiplied stands in potency to a principle of multiplication. Now, if we have something which is pure existence, in order to be multiplied, it has to stand as subject to something other than it, which would multiply it.
Yeah.
But if it's pure existence, there's nothing other than it to which it stands as subject. And so the principle behind Thomas's reasoning here, that if you have something which is pure existence, there's nothing other than it which could multiply it in any way. Hence, it resists any possible mode of multiplication. And so in itself, it is one and utterly unique if it exists. So it's a conceptual truth about something which is pure existence, something whose essence is its existence, that it's one and utterly unique. You couldn't have more than one of them. Now, Thomas is going to take us to the real distinction of essence and existence, but we can stop there for a minute if we need to unpack that.
Great. Let me see if I'm following here. So in thinking about angels and thinking about immaterial creatures and trying to still understand these beings in some way in potency, because we don't want to say they're purely actual. Aquinas comes through his philosophical reasoning to two fundamental principles in a thing, essence and existence. And we don't need any kind of matter for angels because we have essence now as the principle of potentiality, and we have esse, or the act of existence, as the principle actuality. Whereas in Aristotelianism, it's matter and form that are playing those principles. Aquinas pushes it deeper. But at this point, Aquinas just has a conceptual distinction between these things, between these principles and a thing. So then the next stage, he conceptualizes what it would be like for a being to exist that was just pure existence itself, where there was no distinction, no conceptual distinction between existence and essence. And that's where we've arrived.
Yes. Yeah. And so here's the really cool thing that Thomas does. So if it is a conceptual truth about something whose essence is its existence, that it could only be one, there couldn't be more than one of them, it would be utterly unique, then it is impossible to be that thing without being one and unique. Okay.
Yes.
So just, So, and bear in mind, it's a conceptual truth about something whose essence is its existence. We're dealing with conceptual truths here. My interpretation, Whipple's interpretation, the first stage is dealing with, you know, conceptual issues. The second stage is remaining with conceptual issues. So there's a kind of, you know, a nice unity there that we're still at the conceptual sphere.
And for anybody who knows Aquinas, Anyone listening who knows Aquinas, they'll know that Aquinas will not go from the conceptual to the actual. We know that, even if it's not spelled out exactly here in this passage in On Being and Essence. We know that because he rejects the ontological argument.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which was exactly the attempt to go from a conceptualization of the nature and definition of God to his actual existence. And Aquinas rejects that on the principle that you can't go from thought to things.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
And indeed, he critiques the Platonists for making the same sort of move. He says that, the Platonists jumped from the way forms exist in the mind to saying that's how they exist in reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a criticism he levels at the Platonists. So, you know, Thomas isn't going to jump from some sort of positive mental conception to a real conception. So what he does here is that he holds, well, look, if it's a conceptual truth about something whose essence is its existence, that it would be one and unique, then it would be impossible to be that thing and not be one and unique.
Right.
Okay. Now we're talking of the language of impossibility here. It would be impossible to be something whose essence is its existence and not be one and unique. So it's not possible for there to exist anything in reality whose essence is its existence, which isn't one and unique. That conceptual impossibility translates into a real impossibility.
I see.
That is a move that Thomas and many others are going to make, that if you can show that something is in itself impossible, it's really impossible. Okay, it's not a possibility, because possibility is a necessary but not sufficient condition for actuality. Well, look, armed with this, Thomas says, well, look, if we have multiple beings, then they are not something whose essence is its existence. Why? Because something whose essence is its existence is one and unique. It's conceptually impossible for it not to be one and unique. So if we have things which are multiple, they are not something whose essence is its existence. And if they're not things in which essence and existence are identical, there are things in which essence and existence are distinct. So if we grant that there are real multiple beings, which we do because we're realists, then we know at least that they are not that hypothetical being whose essence is its existence. There may be other things, whatever they are, we can just investigate that, but they are at least not that thing whose essence is its existence, because they're not one and unique. So given the reality of multiplicity, we can then infer from the fact that such things aren't things in which essence and existence are identical. They are things in which essence and existence are distinct. And it's at that stage that I and Whipple hold that the real distinction is established, because we now have real things in our sights of which we can affirm that their essence and their existence are distinct.
Excellent. So if hypothetically you have a being whose essence and existence are identical, a conceptual analysis shows you that there can only be one, but then we look around and we see that there are a multitude of beings, and therefore we know that in this multitude of beings, they have to consist of these fundamental principles that are really distinct of essence and existence. Excellent. So
that's it. Yeah.
We've got the real distinction. Let's make the argument for God.
Yeah. Brilliant. And the more I read this, the more I'm just sitting thinking, you know, what was I doing in my early 30s? You know?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. And what must St. Thomas's confreres at St. Jacques, who were finding metaphysics at the University of Paris so difficult that they ended up getting this out of St. Thomas? What was being taught at Paris, you know, that Thomas had to write this?
Right.
But this was easier to understand for them than what
Aquinas grew up. Aquinas grew up in an age where there was no social media and no video games, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, right, let's get to the next stage. So we've established a real distinction between essence and existence. And Thomas is like, right, now let's think about things in which essence and existence are distinct. How are essence and existence related to each other in the thing? And Thomas holds, well, look, if you've got things and they have, you know, a certain feature or characteristic about them, they either have that characteristic as a result of their intrinsic nature or some intrinsic principle, or as a result of some extrinsic principle. So the example that he gives is risibility, the ability to laugh. Human beings are able to laugh because of their intrinsic nature, because they're rational animals. So they're able to entertain humor, get a joke because of their rationality. They can see that something is funny. So that's a feature that they have, which is derived from their intrinsic nature. But then he says, you know, think about the illumination of the atmosphere by the sun. The atmosphere is illuminated by the sun, not through anything intrinsic to the atmosphere. It's not self-illuminating. It requires some principle extrinsic to the atmosphere, which is the light from the sun. Thomas's point here then is that, you know, well, look, we have this situation. A thing has some sort of characteristic, either as a result of its intrinsic nature or as a result of some extrinsic principle. Well, what about things which have existence, but, you know, essence and existence are distinct? Well, we know that they can't have existence because, as a result of their intrinsic nature, their essence, because we've just shown that essence and existence are distinct. So they need to have existence from some extrinsic principle in the way that, you know, the atmosphere is illuminated by the sun. Well, Thomas thinks, well, that's interesting. That means that, you know, there's some sort of extrinsic principle by means of which I and you and other things which are multiple have the existence to which we are not identical. And that then sets up a causal chain, causal regress. And Thomas holds, and we'll get into this argumentation, that that causal regress terminates in some sort of primary source of existence, which isn't something which essence and existence are identical, but is something which essence and existence, which isn't something which essence and existence are distinct, but something which essence and existence are identical. And so it all is going to turn, it's all going to turn in this analysis of that causal series that Thomas considers, and frustratingly, he doesn't consider it in the De Ente. Now, yeah. he gives a remark which relates it to what he establishes in other works, and so you sort of need to take what he's written in other works and sort of line it up with that remark that he gives. But frustratingly, he doesn't spell this out in the De Ente.
Do you think Aquinas thought that to his audience it was just obvious?
I think given that these people were, you know, doing philosophy at the University of Paris, that they would have been familiar with the similar reasoning that you find in Aristotle Metaphysics Book 2, Aristotle Metaphysics Book 12, and Aristotle's Physics Book 8, okay. I think.
Yeah.
I know the metaphysics better than the physics, but I think it's Book 8. I think, you know, that in this passing remark, his readers would have been like, oh, well, that's what he's referring to there.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And then it's in later other works that Thomas, you know, digs deep into this.
Right.
Yeah. So should we consider causal series?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was one of my earliest articles that I wrote. It's the distinction between what are called per se and per accidens causal series and the metaphysics of per se and per accidens causal series. I wrote an article, I think it was in 2012. It was titled Essentially Ordered Series Reconsidered, published in the American Catholic Phil Quarterly, and then republished in the Collected Articles volume. And in it, I sort of articulate Aquinas's metaphysics of per se causal series. And then this is the material that I used to, you know, buttress his reasoning in the De Ente here. So we'll dive into the difference between these two causal series. We'll see why one of them has to terminate in the primary and the other doesn't. And then we'll get into how that relates to the De Ente argument. Does that sound cool?
That sounds great.
Brilliant. So we can easily envisage chains of causal series. You know, one cause causes an effect, and that causes something, and that causes something, so on, in either direction. So it's very easy for us to set up causal chains. But the medievals, following the Islamic philosophers, particularly Avicenna, following Aristotle and that, you know, tradition, noted that there are two different kinds of causal series, two different types of causal series. There is one type of causal series in which the members of the series possess the causality of the series, the causal power, the causal actuality of the series intrinsically in themselves. So each member of the series has the causal power of the series in virtue of what it is. And then there's another type of causal series in which the members don't possess the causality, the causal power of the series intrinsically. Okay, they don't possess it in virtue of what they are. So the very causality which is in the series needs some sort of cause in that second type of causal series. And the best way to think our way into this is to consider two different examples. So the first type of causal series, the sort of series in which the members possess the causality of the series essentially or in virtue of what they are, that's called an accidentally ordered or a per accidens causal series. And the example that Thomas typically gives is a series of fathers producing sons. So you imagine Peter produces James and James produces John, okay? So Peter exercises his causality for paternity and he fathers James. So we have James. And then James grows up, exercises his causality of paternity, he produces John. And then John goes on and so forth and so on. And we can go back and back and back. We can consider Peter's father and so on and so forth. But notice something about that series. The particular causality involved is that of paternity, fathering, begetting. They exercise the causality of paternity to produce their sons. And each member of the series has that causality, not because of their previous members, but because of what they are. Okay, so why is it that Peter is able to father James? It's not because of his father. It's because Peter's a grown man who is biologically capable of doing what needs to be done to father a child. Okay, Peter's father is dead by that point. Given that his father's not on the scene, Peter doesn't need him in order to father his own son. So usually when I teach this to my students, I say, imagine Peter fathers James. Okay, James is born. Okay. Wife is recovering in the hospital, you know, the child is all there and everything, and Peter goes out to wet the baby's head. Now, are you familiar with that statement, wetting the baby's head?
I was just going to say, I have no idea what you're talking about there.
So it's not baptism, or you could call it an Irish baptism. In Ireland, when we talk about wetting the baby's head, it means we go out and celebrate by means of certain beverages, the birth of our new child.
Yeah. I see, yeah.
So, you could call that an Irish baptism, but yeah, so wetting the baby's head, you go out for your whiskies and your Guinness and stuff to celebrate that, you know, James has just been born. Now, I imagine Peter does that, you know, James is all tucked up in the hospital, you know, wife is happy and everything. Out he goes to wet the baby's head, tragically dies, okay? Goes out for drinks and dies that night. All right, okay, that's a tragedy. Will that stop James from fathering his own child? No. James can grow up and father his own child because he's a biologically functioning male. Yeah. So he has the causality of paternity in himself. He doesn't need Peter's help. He doesn't need Peter's help to father his own son.
So he has the built-in causal power.
Exactly. He has this causal power intrinsically in virtue of what he is, and he can father John. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, Peter is John's grandson, or Peter is John's grandfather, but Peter's dead. So Peter within this line of causality, doesn't play a causal role with regard to John.
Right.
And then if John has a child, it's only John who plays that causal role in fathering. Mm-hmm. So in Peraccident's causal series, causality is discharged in the immediately succeeding member of the series. Okay. You don't need, you know, to depend on the earlier members in order to have the present members. Okay. The earlier members can pass out, but the present members can remain, and the series remains because as long as you have a present member, you have that causality in that present member intrinsically.
Yep.
And so Aquinas in the medievals, you know, more generally, more or less held that see these kinds of causal series, they don't need a primary cause. You can go back as far as you want without a beginning, so long as, you know, you have a father, produces a son, he dies, produces a son, he dies, and so on and so on. As long as you keep having successive members, you don't need a first in this series. There's no issue there. So Peraccident's causal series can be infinite. And St. Thomas holds this. Peraccident's causal series can be infinite. But now we move to the second type of causal series, per se, or essentially ordered causal series, and they're contrasted with the father-son series, with the Peraccident's causal series. In these types of series, the members of the series don't possess the causality in themselves, or per se. They don't have that causal power in themselves. Peter, James, and John have the causality of begetting or paternity in themselves. Mm-hmm. But in per se series, the members don't have the causality of the series in themselves. Common example is the mental agent moves his hands to move the stick to move the stone. So the hands, stick, and stone, they don't have the causality of motion in themselves. Hands can be hands, sticks, sticks, and stones without moving. Okay? Mm-hmm. They don't need to move in order to be hands, sticks, and stones. They can be moved, but they don't have motion essentially. So were there not a cause for that causality that they have, they would be immobile. They wouldn't move. And so what is the cause of that causality? It's the mental agent. A mental agent, being rational, is just something which has in itself the ability to engage in action. Okay? Mm-hmm. Agents can engage in action, and that can induce motion to the hand, the stick, and the stone. But if the mental agent doesn't induce motion to the hand, the stick, and the stone, then the hand, the stick, and the stone, they don't move. So I give the example of the golf player on the golf course. Okay, he goes to the golf course, swings the club, hits the ball, and we're good. He induces motion to his hands, to the club and the ball, and you have that action of the ball being moved. But imagine he goes to swing, he has some sort of irreparable brain damage, and he can't follow through. Well, there's no more motion in the series then. Some other source of motion takes over, like gravity, for example. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. takes over then. Because the hands, the club, and the ball in themselves are essentially immobile. They don't have the causality of the series, essentially. Now, Aquinas holds that these types of causal series cannot be without a primary. And we're going to see what a primary cause is in this series. But it's these kinds of causal series that cannot be a primary. If you take away the mental agent from the hand, stick, stone series, there's no motion in the series. They're just, you would have to substitute that with a different source of motion, something which originates the motion. Another example is the fire heats a pot, which heats the contents of the pot. The pot and its contents in themselves are not heated. They need to be brought to a source of heat that they can draw upon in order to be heated. And fire, just in virtue of what fire is, heats, gives off heat. It wouldn't be fire unless it gave off heat. A mental agent would not be a mental agent were it not able to induce motion. And this reveals something about primary causes and secondary causes in these types of causal series. A secondary cause in a per se causal series is something which doesn't possess the causality of the series, essentially. A primary cause does possess the causality of the series, essentially, because it has to originate that causality. So it has to have in itself the wherewithal to originate the causality in the hand, the stick, and the stone. Or the fire has to have in itself the wherewithal to originate heat in the pot and in its contents. So a primary cause in this kind of causal series has that causality essentially in virtue of what it is. And if you don't have that primary cause, you don't have a causal series.
Yeah.
Because that's where the causality for that series comes from. So it's very much a different type of series than the per accidens causal series.
Great.
Okay.
That sounds good. Yeah. So just we're just talking about two kinds of possible causal series here. One is mm-hmm. accidental, the other one's per se, or we could say essential.
Yeah.
And with the accidental, each causal link in the chain has the causality built in, so they can yes. pass it on to the next link.
Spot
That's
on.
The accidental yep. form. And that can go on forever, mm. at least for Aquinas. Those who, yeah. Who like the Kalam cosmological argument mm. today will deny that that kind of series can go on forever. But yeah. nevertheless, for Aquinas, that kind of series can go on forever, doesn't need a primary or first cause. But then with the per se causal series, you don't have built-in causality, which each link in the chain. Rather, mm-hmm. the causality within the chain itself is derivative.
Yes.
It's borrowed. And each link in the chain has the causality it does only instrumentally, insofar as mm-hmm. the causality that it does has is actually the causal action of the primary cause, rather than kind of a built-in kind of causality that each link in the chain has.
Yeah, absolutely. Spot on. Another example is that, you know, the sun illuminates the moon, which illuminates, you know, the earth. Let's say if it's a full moon, it's nighttime. And it's not really the moon illuminating the earth. It's the moon reflecting the light of the sun.
Yeah.
So the earth and the moon are both participating in the light of the sun. The hand, the stick, and the stone, or the hand, the golf club, and the golf ball are participating in the motion that the mental agent conveys to them. And so per se ordered series, essentially ordered series then, must have a primary cause. Otherwise, you just do not have causality in the series. The members don't have it in themselves have that causality. They need something in which they participate for that causality. Now, we swing back to the De Entia Essentia here. because this lines up neatly with Thomas's division of things having characteristics either as a result of their intrinsic nature or as a result of some extrinsic principle. Remember, you know, risibility in humans, we have that because of what we are, really, we have that intrinsically. The illumination of the atmosphere by the sun, we have that extrinsically. Well, existence then. We've seen that essence and existence are distinct. Okay, do things have existence as a result of their intrinsic nature? No, because essence and existence are distinct. So existence is not possessed by things in which essence and existence are distinct in the way that, you know, the fathers and sons possess paternity, the causality of begetting. Okay, they possess that causality intrinsically in virtue of what they are, but we don't possess existence in virtue of what we are. So the causality of our existence is not locatable within a per accidens ordered series.
Mm-hmm.
What about per se ordered series? In a per se ordered series, the causality that the members have, they don't have essentially, they simply participate in it. Well, what about our existence? We don't have that essentially, we simply participate in our existence. And if we simply participate in our existence, that means that existence is a causal feature locatable in a per se ordered series.
Mm-hmm.
And what did we infer about per se ordered series? If you do not have a primary cause, which essentially possesses the causality of the series, the mental agent inducing motion to the hand, stick, and stone, the fire, the heat, to the pot and the contents, if you don't have a primary cause, which essentially has that causality, you don't have a causal series. We're thinking now existence is a type of causality. If you don't have a primary cause, which essentially has existence, i.e. whose essence is its existence, you don't have a causal series of which existence is the causal power. In other words, you don't have things in which essence and existence are distinct. You just do not have existence which participate in existence. So unless you have a primary cause, you don't have things in which essence and existence are distinct. We Great. Do have things in which essence and existence are distinct, in which case there is a primary cause whose essence is identical to its existence. And just before we drop the mic, remember stage two, Thomas considers this hypothetical being whose essence is its existence. And what did he establish? It's one and unique, but also it's not material. It doesn't subsist in matter. It subsists in virtue of what it is. So we have a single, unique, immaterial source of all existence without which nothing would be. And if God has been understood to be anything,
it's that's this. It. Yeah, that's right. So lots of questions come to mind. We'll have to have you back, Gavin. This has just been so fun. But I would love to have you come back and unpack how we go from this being whose essence it is to exist, you know, that doesn't have a distinction between essence and existence, just pure existence itself.
Yeah.
Or as you say in the book, esse tantum.
Yep.
How do we go from that, from the biblical concept to the biblical conception of God? How does Aquinas weave these two, the metaphysical conception with the biblical conception? That is a whole, and you address this in the book, you do it great. That's a whole separate question. But with the time that we have remaining here, gosh, this, the nature of a metaphysical argument, in my opinion, to see the power of a metaphysical argument, you need time for it to bake in the oven, right? You need it.
Yeah.
You need to let the principles kind of get absorbed into your mind. And
yeah.
Because it's, when it comes to these principles, it's really a matter of kind of an intellectual seeing, isn't it? Because they're basic first principles. So for me, the longer you think about an argument like the one Aquinas offers in De Ante, the more powerful it becomes, it like ages like a good wine, right? It gets better with time, the more you think about it. So it seems to me that this is such a powerful metaphysical argument. So in the time we have remaining, let me just ask you, what do you think is the biggest objection to accepting the conclusion for this argument?
Yeah, spot on. I think the biggest objection to this argument is the objection which would say that this kind of metaphysical reasoning is impossible, that you just can't do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Which explains why I've devoted a lot of my time to the thought of Immanuel Kant, because Kant was very famous for setting out to clip the wings of the rationalist metaphysicians. really, it was Leibniz that he had in mind. But Kant very famously wanted to show that metaphysics that goes beyond the bounds of sense, to use Strawson's language, is impossible. And so there's a kind of Kantianism, not the Kantianism that I would adopt, but there's a certain strain of Kantianism which would say that this kind of metaphysical reasoning is impossible. We have to remain within the bounds of sense. Otherwise, we have transgressed the proper domain of metaphysics. I think objections inspired by that. So you've got that. You've got the logical, more logical positivist sort of objections that, you know, any use of terms which goes beyond, you know, our observation terms or protocol sentences is a misuse of terms. And we're using terms, you know, unintelligibly. I think they're all the strongest objections to this argument. So in other words, it's something that we sort of observed earlier on, that this isn't apologetics. This isn't just finding an argument for God. This is actually coming out as a fruit of metaphysics.
Right. So
something which attacks metaphysics per se is just going to, it's going to be like weed killer. It's just going to, if you destroy it at the roots, you destroy anything that grows from the roots. And this proof grows out of the roots of metaphysics. And it seems to me that, you know, strains of Kantianism, logical positivism, they're just attacking the roots of metaphysics. And so I think that's where the strongest objections are coming from.
Yeah. So if you're going to resist this argument, it's not like some of the other arguments that are popular today for the existence of God, you know, just, arguing over some scientific fact or something like that, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to resist this argument, you really got to get your hands dirty in the metaphysics. Yeah. And that's really where this argument is this, the war around this argument is going to be fought. And fortunately, for those of us who have studied this for a long time, that is encouraging, because at least it seems to me that the metaphysics upon which this argument stands are strong, are very strong.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, it's the actual metaphysics. I mean, it's not just focused on this argument. It's an entire systematic metaphysics, and that's what you have to tackle. Now, fair enough. I mean, not even in the German idealist tradition, but think Scotus, Occam, all their medieval metaphysicians provide alternatives by
that's
which
right.
this argument can be rejected, you know. So I mean, you get to, you even get alternative, you know, metaphysics there that can object to this argument. But it is, as you say, it's going to be a metaphysical wrestling match, which is good, because I mean, Thomas, you know, is, you know, quite a, you know, a talented metaphysician.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, for me, yeah, that's, let's take it metaphysical. That's exactly where you know, we want to hash this out anyway. So finally, something I have to mention here, when you think about these arguments, Aquinas's arguments, even the arguments he makes in his Summa Theologica, the objection that always comes up nowadays is this idea of existential inertia. Can you just explain quickly what is existential inertia?
Yeah.
And how do we overcome it?
Yeah. Okay. So the existential inertia objection, sort of, it's come up recently, especially since Fieser started, you know, defending variations of this argument. And it's come up recently because in Fieser's presentation of it, he points out that the causes and effects in per se causal series have to be concurrent with each other. Okay, there has to be some sort of concurrence. So later effects within the series have to be concurrent with earlier causes, such that the later effects wouldn't come about were they not to come about simultaneously with the activity of earlier causes. And this is something, just on a scholarly issue, this is something which isn't actually a feature of Thomas's metaphysics of per se causal series. It's a feature of Scotus's metaphysics of per se ordered series. In the De Primo Principio, Scotus outlines three features of essentially ordered series. And one of the features is that in essentially ordered series, all the members of the series have to act simultaneously, so that if you don't have a first cause, you don't have any other causes in the series.
Yeah.
And so that's where this concurrent objection comes about. And the existential inertia objection, it came from Graham Oppie and is later being developed by Joseph Schmidt, is that, well, no, hold on a minute. Things can just get existence, keep existence, and they'll keep that existence not because of the concurrence of some earlier cause, but just because there's nothing which comes along to, you know, stop them having existence.
So it's like Newton's inertial law.
Yeah.
An object stays in motion until it's interacted with something else.
Yeah, more or less, something like that. And so now you find early versions of this in the ancient Greek atomists. You find a notion of this in Spinoza with his, you know, canatus ascendi, this striving to be. But it's been very much an unexplored sort of position in the literature. And unfortunately, because it's come up within the context of, you know, arguments for the existence of God, the discussion of it hasn't been detached from that argumentation, which means really there hasn't been an opportunity to explore the metaphysics of existential inertia independent of sort of back and forths on arguments for the existence of God. And I say that's unfortunate because, as we were just pointing out, if we're going to challenge these arguments, we need to get, you know, deep into the metaphysics. And if we don't have a metaphysics of existential inertia, we just have it being, you know, sort of used to kind of attack
just
this argument.
An objection, yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult to deal with it. Now, so I published an article on existential inertia, which is, it's now in the collected articles book. And I also sort of engaged with it in my defense of the first way, Aquinas' first way as well. And the point that I make is that existence doesn't behave like an inertial property. If we take typical inertial properties, you know, Oppie talks about, you know, color properties. Mm-hmm. Color properties, let's say, you know, the color of the fabric of a chair. Okay, so a chair is dyed a certain color, it'll remain that color until it's dyed a different color. You know, you don't need to have the efficient cause of the dyeing of the chair present to it in order for it to remain red instead of green. Okay, so inertial properties, you know, like that, they presuppose an existing subject in which they subsist. So the dye of the chair presupposes the chair in which it subsists. So the dye remains because the chair remains.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it has something in which to subsist. Now, does existence, if existence were an inertial property, it would have to presuppose a subject in which to subsist. But Aquinas' notion of esse doesn't behave like that. Mm-hmm. Aquinas' esse doesn't presuppose a subject in which to exist. Rather, all subjects presuppose esse.
That's right. Yeah.
In order to exist. So whatever you want to say about esse, it can't behave as an inertial property because inertial properties presuppose a pre-existing subject, whereas the act of existence establishes the subject outright. So that if the subject didn't have existence, you just wouldn't have subsistence. And insofar as the subject doesn't have existence essentially, it requires that cause for its existence so long as it exists.
Excellent. Well, that's a great first pass. Obviously, this is a big subject, and maybe we'll have to have you back on to talk about existential inertia specifically.
Oh, yeah. Happy to do so. Yeah.
Yeah. So just with Fazer, I have heard Fazer clarify. I mean, he in response to criticisms, Fazer has said, you know, the essential feature of a per se ordered series is not simultaneity, it's rather instrumentality.
Yeah.
That each link in the chain has the causality instrumentally. So I have seen him clarify that in certain places. But anyway. Yeah. So Gavin, man, thanks so much. This has been so much fun. But before we say goodbye here, what are you up to now? Like, what are you working on recently?
Yeah. So I'm plugging away at my resurrection book. You know, I'm deep in the wee. Yeah, deep in the weeds of 20th century scripture scholarship, you know. So the major chapters of the book have been written where I go through the whole metaphysics of the resurrection. And so now I kind of have gone back to the introduction and just into 20th century scripture scholarship and commentary and everything. And I'm learning Greek just to do that. And
oh, jeez.
It's like, you know, the 20th century scripture scholarship, it's like the Wild West. I mean, people could say anything they wanted and they got away
with
it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm deep in the weeds of that. As I say, I've signed a book contract, but I need to keep that sort of hush-hush. But there is a book contract and there's a book on the way. There's possibly another book on the way, kind of an introductory book on the five ways. It's looking like a possibility. What else am I working on? I've been contracted to write a chapter for another book on God, Aquinas on God and creation and simplicity in the Summa Contra Gentiles. And I've got an MMA fight in less than 3 weeks coming
up.
So I'm training for that as well.
So what level MMA are we talking here? Is this
Yeah, so I'm 40 years old, so it's a novice fight, you know. So it's weekend warrior sort of stuff, you know, hobby and that sort of stuff. Yeah.
All right, great. Well, hey, Gavin, thanks for coming on Think for Christ. This has been an absolute blast. And man, anytime you want to come back, as soon as you are ready to talk about this new book that's veiled in secrecy, I'd love to find out what that is and get a preview of it here if you'd be willing to do so. So
absolutely. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, thanks for all your work. Like I said, off air here, it's been super influential in my own thinking when it comes to the thought of Aquinas. So keep chugging along. I mean, you are obviously someone who is producing a lot of material. So just keep it up, man. I really appreciate it.